Okay, we're going to begin now. First of all, I want to thank you for showing up to it. This is the second play that's been sponsored by the Sociology and Social Policy section of the BA. Last year in Liverpool, some of you may have read or heard that I staged a play called Lincoln and Darwin, Live for One Night Only, taking advantage of the fact that both Lincoln and Darwin were born on the same day in 1809, and they go back on a talk show. 2009 to reflect on what had happened the previous 200 years. Now this year we have a different topic, and the topic is three women after the soul of William James. And what I want to do is give you a little introduction to sort of the premise of the play. The first thing I should say is that a lot of the views that are expressed by, especially by the female characters, who are the dominant characters in this play, I mean, in a sense William James is kind of a foil. Most of you probably know who William James was. He was a very distinguished American philosopher, typically known as the founder of pragmatism. He flourished at the turn of the last century. He was also founder of the psychology lab at Harvard University, and is generally known as one of the great intellectual figures in the United States, a very influential person in his day. However, in this play, he's a kind of 28-year-old recently a student of medicine who completed his degree, who is touring Europe basically trying to find himself. And this actually does reflect the original biography of William James, who was someone who actually took a long time to figure out what he was about. And so what he does in this, what happens in this play is, he's invited to tea by Harriet Martineau. Now Harriet Martineau is a very distinguished British feminist, who, by the time this this tea party is taking place, which is in 1870, James is 28 years old. Martineau is close to 70 years old. And so for 30, 40 years, she was a very important publicist, not only for women's causes, but also for liberal causes. She was a political economist. She was very much involved in the passage of the Great Reform Bill. And she was also very interested in scientific and spiritualist matters. In fact, she was the translator of Auguste Comte's positivist philosophy from French into English, Harriet Martineau. So she is kind of the anchor person. It's happening in her salon in London in 1870, and that character is played by Rachel Armstrong. The second character to be introduced in the play is Clémence Royer. Clémence Royer is Darwin's French translator. She is a younger person, and is also someone who's very active in women's causes and in scientific causes as well. And in fact, one of the things that you'll see in the play is that she's someone who's really kind of pushing Darwin's views in France very close to eugenics. And in fact, has some very interesting views about the nature of the brain and so forth. And in fact, that's kind of the running theme through the play, namely the relationship between the mind and the brain, and whether there's any kind of validity to something like spiritualism. Okay, and that brings up our third character who gets introduced in the play. Clémence Royer is being played by Zoe Walsh. And the third character is Helena Blavatsky, known as Madame Blavatsky to her fans. And she was a founder of the philosophy known as Theosophy. And she was this person who was known as a kind of channeler, a kind of mystic, into seances, a very influential person in her time, had quite a kind of cult following, and was someone whose psychic powers were very actively investigated by the scientific community. And in fact, many scientists, or at least a few scientists, took her kind of seriously, okay? And so she pays a visit also to Harriet Martineau, and she's the third character to appear on the stage. And all of them are basically offering their views about the relationship between mind and body, about the nature of the relationship between science and religion, their views about Darwin, and they're also trying to give advice to William James as to how he should be conducting his life. Okay, so that's the premise of the play. The play lasts about 45 to 50 minutes. And after the play, there will be a period where we can have some discussion, and if you know anything you want to raise and so forth, especially if you're wondering, well, did they really say that? Because you will hear a lot of strange things coming from the mouths of these characters. And I think generally speaking, the stranger the stuff is, the truer it is. And the stuff that's really made up is the pedestrian stuff, because they never actually met each other, but they knew of each other's work, and they were roughly contemporaries of each other. Okay, so without further ado, I hope you enjoy yourselves, and let's begin.
Mm-hmm. prisoner. Are you home? This is William James. My father recommended that I take tea with you while I'm passing through London. My apologies for not giving you more ample notice. I have a letter of introduction from Mr. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Please do let me in. If the crosswinds don't get the better of me, the polluted air of this Dickensian nightmare of a city will.
Patience, Mr. James. I'm coming. Look at the state of you. Imagine what you'd be like at my age. Come on, sit down and make yourself at home whilst I make some tea.
Oh, I forgot. My letter of introduction from Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Thank you very much for that. Ah, yes. Mr. Emerson. He's a very inspiring speaker and essayist who's done several lecture circuits here. I can't get enough of all that stuff about self-reliance and overcoming this and transcending that. So life-affirming. So empowering. But as you know, he gets it all from the Germans. Kant, Hegel and that lot. Still, I have to hand it to you Americans. Who else could serve up hundreds of pages of run-on sentences in barbaric German as an hour of pithy pabulum expressed in our much more agreeable common tongue?
I hope you don't intend to demean the illustrious Mr. Emerson. He's a close personal friend of my father. He stayed with us whenever he was in New York. In fact, we used to call the guest room Mr. Emerson's room.
Oh, how quaint. And did Mrs. James have a room to herself while Mr. Emerson was in town?
Miss Martineau, whatever are you suggesting? My father and Mr. Emerson share an interest in matters of the spirit.
Spirit? So I'll take it then that your father is not a churchgoer, since Mr. Emerson renounced the church as an unreliable witness to matters of the spirit. Needless to say, this caused great consternation amongst the pious who attended his lectures here. They expected greater respect for the church from someone who wore a clerical collar and addresses such morally uplifting themes.
I had not taken you to be a churchgoer yourself.
That's certainly correct. In fact, I followed much the same spiritual path as Mr. Emerson, having started as a Unitarian Christian and then passed on to something not so easily housed within four walls.
So you're a spiritualist?
Yes, after a fashion, an atheist spiritualist.
Whatever does that mean?
Well, I guess it means what Unitarian ought to mean. Namely, that there's no clear distinction between the divine and the human. We're all in a position to incorporate the cosmic forces into our being.
Oh, and how exactly is that supposed to happen? Remember, you're speaking to someone who holds a medical degree.
And you remember that I am someone who managed to be cured of heart disease, chronic exhaustion, and an ovarian cyst, all through the power of the will.
Yes, I've read your journals on self-healing, in which you seem to treat medicine as if it were one of Mr. Emerson's self-improvement schemes. I keep on looking for the science that underlies the success of these purported cures.
I am crystal clear about the relevant science. Mesmerism.
Mesmerism? You must be kidding. Anton Mesmer was already exposed for charlatanry nearly a century ago. One of America's founding fathers, Dr. Benjamin Franklin, nearly 80 years old by then, was called out to Paris to lead the commission that found Mesmer to be a fraud. Do you even understand how mesmerism is supposed to work?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. I undertook a study of it to inform people more generally about its benefits. And once you set Dr. Mesmer's Jesuit-inspired metaphysics to one side, he's really talking about a sense of controlled relaxation that enables what he calls animal magnetism. Something that permeates the entire universe to flow more regularly through our bodies. All illness results from the blockage of this flow. Pure and simple. Enough blockages, and you die. Again, plain and simple.
No, sorry, not so plain and simple. The smart medical money, at least in Germany where I've been recently, is that disease is more to do with microbes, very small foreign invaders that prey upon our bodies and pervert their normal functioning.
Oh, really? And how many of these microbe creatures does it take to fell a full-bodied adult? And are they just being generated all over the place, or do they come from special locations?
I don't think you quite catch the spirit of the proposal.
Oh, I think I do. You're talking about a view of nature, however scientific in appearance, that would have us once again cower before invisible forces beyond our control.
Most definitely not beyond our control. There are all sorts of precautions and treatments that can be made. And both France and Germany have begun to take measures to protect their populations from the worst effects, especially now that they're again at war with each other. Rumor has it that new drugs, including vaccines, are being applied to the troops of both countries to increase their resistance to strange environments and otherwise insalubrious fighting conditions.
I knew it. This is a scheme for states to accrue power to themselves by making individuals feel defenseless before an imaginary threat. The medical establishment is trying to set itself up as a secular priesthood. Just when I thought we'd left the Dark Ages. Now we're being plunged right back into them.
Miss Martineau, you're being hysterical.
Oh, and is that your clinical judgment, Mr. James? Or are you just trying to intimidate a woman who is willing and able to speak her own mind?
Well, put it this way. I don't feel especially attracted by your animal magnetism.
In any case, Mr. James, you claim to be so hard-headed and scientific, but I am not at all impressed by Dr. Franklin's conclusions concerning Dr. Mesmer.
Well, they were endorsed by the great chemist Lavoisier and the eminent Dr. Guillotin. Do you mean to be going against their judgments as well?
Ah, yes, Guillotin, the man who provided the world with a guillotine as an efficiency saving over torture and imprisonment, let alone due process of law. Pardon my cynicism, but a man who knows exactly where to sever the head to cause maximum damage with minimum pain is not necessarily the first person I would turn to advice on what happens inside the head when it is still attached to the body.
That's all well and good, Miss Martineau, but have you closely studied Dr. Franklin's reasoning?
Why, of course. I make a close study of the evidence and the inferences drawn from them before making up my own mind. Only animals and plants have nature imprinted on them, like some workman's boot. We humans are capable of deciding what to believe. Don't you ever forget that, Mr. James. We are just as responsible for our beliefs as our actions.
I appreciate the sermon, but as for Dr. Franklin's scientific failings?
Well, as I recall, Dr. Franklin had a glass of water mesmerized and then asked a sufferer of some mental anguish to drink several glasses of water, including the mesmerized one, but without knowing which was which. As Dr. Mesmer would predict, the sufferer passed out from drinking from one of the glasses.
Yes, the wrong glass.
It was a wrong experiment.
What could you mean by that?
Dr. Franklin, whatever his many talents, and I have been always very impressed by his ability to channel electricity, simply did not have a good grasp of the underlying principles of mesmerism.
Oh, so now you're going to smuggle in some of that Jesuit metaphysics you were trying to avoid earlier.
Oh, Mr. James, you need to learn when to be credulous and when to be sceptical, since you seem to have got them the wrong way round. Mesmerism works by enabling one's animal magnetism to redistribute itself across the body. First, the physician establishes what Dr. Mesmer called rapport with the patient. This rapport instills in the patient a confidence that his malady will be treated. This in turn causes the patient to focus on his ailment, but in a state of calm that enables him to see it clearly for what it is, and therefore come across it, or overcome it, in the most straightforward means possible.
Sounds like a kinder and gentler approach to exorcism. I thought you were going to keep the Jesuits out of this.
Mr. James, how you disappoint me. There is nothing mysterious about what I'm talking about. Men of science have written about inducing this process on themselves in sleep to remove barriers that lie in the way of solving problems. Since you seem to be fond of Germans, I refer you to Professor Kekulé at Bonn University. He is now widely credited with putting organic chemistry on a firm scientific basis, a feat he himself credits to a dream in which he imagined a benzene molecule as a snake chasing its own tail, which inspired his discovery of the molecule's structural properties.
Well, that's all fine and good, but what you fail to appreciate, Miss Martineau, is that Dr. Franklin clearly showed Dr. Mesmer's treatments worked only because his patients believed they would work.
On the contrary, Mr. James, I am well aware of that. In fact, that was precisely the point of Dr. Mesmer's treatments. He wanted the patients to participate in their own recovery. They're not simply pieces of meat waiting to be served up like some main course, having been prepared with various probes and pills. They're agents of their own destiny.
And what happens if, or rather when, the patients relapse, if not perish altogether? due to a lack of proper medical treatment? Do you then blame the victim's lack of willpower?
Well, yes, such patients failed to follow through on their original commitment to the treatment. They manifested a weakness of will. But now, let me turn the tables on you, Mr. James. Did Dr. Franklin ever bother to compare Dr. Mesmer's success rate with that of more orthodox practitioners of medicine? Did he bother to check whether even they performed better when their patients believed that they would be cured by the various probes and pills that filled their bodies?
No, I suppose you have a point there.
Dr. Mesmer was being persecuted simply because he had tapped into what makes medicine of any sort really work. The will to believe. The church couldn't abide him because they claimed a monopoly over matters of the spirit. And the materialists couldn't abide him because he claimed to be getting a scientific handle on something that wasn't supposed to exist.
Well, if it's any consolation, Miss Martineau, the smart medical money says that there might be something to mesmerism after all. Some distinct psychic state that under proper experimental conditions can be induced in patients. However, the exact nature of this state and whatever therapeutic benefits might be derived from being in it remain to be seen.
Oh, yes, I know. Hypnotism. Oh, I hear a knock at the door.
I didn't know you were inviting guests.
Oh, yes. I thought you might benefit from the lively and informed opinions of three women.
Elliot, it is bloody freezing out there. Oh, and frankly, it's not much warmer in here.
Now, Clemence, you need to take better care of yourself. Have you been eating properly? Taking adequate exercise? Still seeing that Republican politician who refuses to leave his wife? Oh, and how's your young bastard, Renee?
Pascal is not a politician, but a public intellectual.
Oh, I know, but that's what you French people say when you mean a politician in exile. Switzerland, I believe, in Pascal's case. Not much of a public there.
No, that's not what I mean.
Oh, that's right. By a public intellectual, you sometimes mean an academic whose failure to make a mark in his specialist field is a sign that he's destined for greater things.
Oh, really, Elliot? Why do you invite me to these teas if all you do is insult me?
No, am I insulting you? I'm simply holding a mirror to your soul. Oh, sorry, I forgot. You don't believe in the soul. My mistake. Maybe I am insulting you after all. My apologies. Being a materialist, you'll appreciate that my remarks have been conditioned by no more than expectations based on past encounters with you. And so they should be treated more as verbal reflexes.
So, who do we have here?
Oh, Clemence Royer. Meet Mr. William James. He's the son of a wealthy something or other from America. James Sr. seems to have discovered the world of learning in his old age, not to mention an erotic fixation on Ralph Waldo Emerson, and has decided to make his son experience all of it firsthand by travelling around Europe. Isn't that right, Mr. James?
That's not exactly how I would have put it.
Oh, I see. Wealthy American heir doing the tour of Europe. Nothing new there. Have you been anywhere a bit more challenging? Asia, Africa, South America, perhaps?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes. I spent a few months assisting Professor Louis Agassiz on a voyage to Brazil, where he was collecting specimens for the Natural History Museum at Harvard.
You don't say.
Oh, Clemence, I hope you're not planning to take advantage of our guest.
Oh, tell me, Mr. James, what was Professor Agassiz's view of Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species? Surely you must know about it, as well as Professor Agassiz's staunch disapproval of anything to do with evolution.
Mr. James, you may not know this, but Clemence is the French translator of Darwin's great book. And every time he comes out with a new edition, she takes the opportunity to append even lengthier introductions. To be sure, in the guise of a translator's preface, that provides her a platform for her political views. Isn't that right, Clemence?
Whatever. Now, Mr. James, you were saying about Professor Agassiz's views on Darwin.
Well, I must confess that I did not have an opportunity to speak with him much about Darwin.
You're too busy collecting specimens?
No, I'm afraid too busy being ill. I was inspired to join Professor Agassiz's Brazilian expedition upon reading Darwin's own Beagle memoirs. But soon, after the ship set sail, I began to realize I wasn't cut out for that sort of thing. In fact, while I was studying medicine, I realized I wasn't cut out for that either.
And weren't you an art student before that?
Well, yes, actually, I liked painting, and I was good at it, but my father didn't think it was a proper career.
Sounds like you're going nowhere fast.
Elliot, don't discourage Mr. James. He was about to tell us about Agassiz and Darwin.
Well, madame...
Mademoiselle, remember the bastard.
Well, Mademoiselle Royer, I should say that Professor Agassiz and Mr. Darwin do share certain research methods. Both really enjoy, and even have a flair for, immersing themselves in nature in all of its habitats. Darwin's flair clearly lies in writing about it, but Agassiz, and I speak firsthand from my experience of him as a student at Harvard, had a flair for teaching. He revolutionized our course of study by lecturing us from field sites, where he demonstrated with elaborate laboratory preparation, without laboratory preparation, how to approach various plant and animal species in order to derive the maximum insight from them.
But Mr. James, getting your hands dirty was not your cup of tea.
No, it wasn't, but that doesn't mean I didn't see the value of it. I also thought that Agassiz's much-publicized opposition to evolution had radical political consequences, especially in light of the civil war that occurred in my country shortly after Darwin's book was published. Far from being a supporter of slavery, Professor Agassiz believed that Negroes should be repatriated to their historic African homelands because, well, basically, God built them to live there. Agassiz thought that both slave owners and even the abolitionists got it badly wrong in their shared view that the Negroes should remain in America at all. Whether free or enslaved, they would always be out of place in our country. At least that was his view.
Clearly, your Professor Agassiz has never heard of free trade or any other liberal idea. His is a universe where every species has its place, and every place its species. It's biological feudalism of the first order. Exactly what I would expect from a creationist. Even one who likes getting soil between his fingernails.
Hush up, Elliot. Let Mr. James finish.
Well, I've also read Professor Agassiz's appraisals of Darwin's work, the empirical side of which he rates very highly. However, he questions how Mr. Darwin exercises his imagination in making up for absent data. On the one hand, Darwin appears quick to infer that evolution occurs by small, gradual changes, even though the geological record suggests the wholesale creations and extinctions of species, as in the Great Ice Age that Professor Agassiz succeeded in demonstrating. On the other hand, Darwin is equally quick to deny any intelligent design, let alone purpose to nature, simply because species are inevitably dispatched in a way that doesn't happen to conform to his own personal sense of justice.
Yes, these are familiar objections here too.
I'm afraid Professor Agassiz was of that Calvinist turn of mind that is happy to hold at once the intelligibility and the uncongeniality of divine creation.
I suppose in that way God keeps his distance from humans, in case there was any hint of confusion.
Darwin always struck me as being of a more tender disposition than Agassiz. He would believe only in a lovable God or none at all.
You raise an interesting point, Mr. James, one with which I think I continue to struggle in my correspondence with Mr. Darwin. I sometimes think he really does believe we are nothing but airless apes. He simply refuses to see the positive side of his own great story.
And what side is that?
That we can take control of evolution and turn natural selection to our collective advantage.
Oh, Clémence, are you still pushing that line? Remember what happened the last time you tried to slip it past Darwin? Mr. James, you may not realize this, but in the first French edition of Darwin's Origin, Clémence translated natural selection as élection naturelle, which left the distinct impression that nature was engaged in some large-scale breeding experiments.
Do you mean what Darwin's cousin Francis Galton has been calling eugenics?
Precisely, Mr. James. A mere typographic convention distinguishes what nature selects and what we elect to do with our species.
I seem to recall that the Catholic Church took a rather different view of the matter and nearly succeeded in getting Darwin's book banned in France, thanks to your creative approach to translation. As Darwin himself was quick to remind you, he had much less trouble with the church on this side of the channel, where we actually understand his theory.
I suspect that Darwin has fallen victim to that fatal British character of understatement.
I'm not so sure about that, mademoiselle. Ever since Darwin finally published Origin, which itself was over 20 years in the making, he's been doing everything he can to distance himself from all the political uses made of his theory.
Clémence, you may recall that I recounted how socially awkward Charles Darwin was in my presence whenever I paid a visit to him and his brother Erasmus at the family home. My, I must have been 30 or 40 years ago now. Even then, all he could talk about at any great length was finches or barnacles. Not what I'd call very engaging company.
Well, Elliot, I'm afraid I know Darwin's side of the story, and he simply found you intimidating and not very pleasing to the eye. He wasn't shy. He was merely averting his gaze. In fact, when I asked Darwin if he had made your acquaintance, he responded by recalling his brother's advice, not to even think of you as a woman. Apparently, it worked wonders, and not only with him.
Well, I'm sure it's been more Darwin's loss than mine. In fact, I hear that he refuses to converse with his wife on any controversial issues, especially spiritual ones, for fear of upsetting her. He might write up a storm about evolution, but he seems to have a hard time recognizing half the population as fit members of his own species.
Ladies, I fear this discourse is descending into unseemly gossip and tittle-tattle.
Mr. James, perhaps you don't realize, but in this country, all liberal-minded, free-thinking individuals want more information to flood into the public domain, including information about sexual conduct and reproduction. That will enable all people, and I mean every sexually active male and female, to decide their own fate in a more considered and justified fashion. John Stuart Mill has been campaigning for this principle, both in and out of Parliament, for many years now. And he's not been helped at all by Mr. Darwin's conspicuous public silences and private misgivings.
It is a distressing feature of Darwin's character, I must admit. Even Herbert Spencer, who's always been much more openly supportive of evolutionary ideas than Mill, has joined Mill on this campaign, taking advantage of the following he has gathered from subscriptions to his work in the United States.
What you failed to see, Clemence, is that in the end, Darwin is a limited thinker. He really does not see science as the great vehicle of enlightenment in the way that you, or I do, and I suppose Mr. James does. Darwin appears to believe that most people would not be able to handle knowledge of contraception sensibly. I suppose he imagines that they would curtail their numbers, which in turn would deplete agriculture and industry of their most vital labour force, whilst all the time opening up opportunities for wanton lust and widespread moral corruption. The more I think about it, the more I can see why the Catholics, at least outside of France, haven't had such a problem with him.
Nevertheless, Miss Martineau, don't you believe that there is something to what Darwin has to say on this score?
No, not really. The more information that is made available to people, the greater the opportunity for them to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. This is why, in my younger years, while Mr. Darwin was staring at finches and barnacles, I was campaigning for reform of the poor laws. You were probably not even born, Mr. James, when our great reform bills were passed in the 1830s. This ended the dreadful perversion of religious sentiment that had led people for nearly 100 years to think that the rich owed the poor a livelihood, because the poor would otherwise never be able to do so for themselves. Mr. Mill, myself, and many others of both sexes, I'm happy to say, argued vigorously and successfully against this demeaning idea. Instead, we called for an end to this dependency culture and its replacement with the provision of incentives for the creation of new schools and new jobs, all in the name of expanding people's freedom of choice.
But Miss Martineau, are you not concerned that people might not rise to the occasion? Indeed, that the wisdom of their choices might be limited by their biological natures? When Professor Agassiz used to lecture about the human races, he would point to the enormous amount of unemployment, destitution, and even homelessness among the freed Negroes of our northern states as evidence that a one-size-fits-all approach to liberty does not work for humanity.
Of course there will be setbacks and failures, some of them no doubt fatal, but it makes the difference in the world when they have been the result of decisions taken from a reasonable range of options. In this case, decisions concerning when and if one starts a family. Anything less would be to deny one's fundamental humanity. In a sense, Mr. James, being human is not a matter of winning or losing. It's how you play the game.
Oh, I'm sorry, Elliot. We can do much better than simply playing games. What is science for, after all? Mr. James is raising a reasonable concern here, but it's one that only a politics clearly grounded in science can properly address. Faced only with the fantasy of promiscuous information flows, it's hardly surprising that Mr. Darwin or Mr. James might have some misgivings. Indeed, individuals are bound to do strange things with what they learn. However, Your fixation on individuals is the last vestige of the old theological worldview that we now need to give up. Yes, Harriet, despite your periodic sneers at the men of the cloth, you still harbor the hope of securing personal salvation for all of humanity. But I'm afraid Darwin has taught us that we need to put an end to that thinking once and for all. Instead, what we need to care for are populations, specifically their long-term survival.
But isn't a population simply a group of individuals in a particular place?
Yes, but the emphasis is placed on the group rather than the individual. To maintain and even strengthen the group, one may need to sacrifice some of the individuals, however heartless or counterintuitive it may seem. This is where eugenics comes in. You will notice that Francis Galton is making his plea for this nascent science to people with influence over government policy, not to ordinary workers and citizens. While I agree with Darwin that no particular individual, nor even a bunch of individuals taken separately, can match the wisdom of natural selection, a concerted political initiative projecting several generations into the future can do so.
But mademoiselle, exactly what would be entailed by your proposal?
Well, Mr. Galton has already shown the way by proposing tax relief for people from accomplished families to mate with each other. But at the other end of the spectrum of humanity, I would also go farther than simply making knowledge of contraception available to the poor. I would mandate the use of contraception on people with proven hereditary deficiencies. And moreover, I would commission research designed to make the identification of such cases easier and more reliable. I have some ideas along these lines, which I will hope to share with you if I get the chance.
Hemos, this is fanciful, even by the standards of your own hyperactive imagination. No wonder Mr. Darwin has refused to have you get anywhere near the French translation of The Descent of Man.
Harriet, I wonder just how deep is your defense of women's equality. In this very book that, as you rightly say, Mr. Darwin will not allow me to translate, he depicts a sex-based division of labor, as if it were a law of nature. He writes about the beauty and docility of the female of the species as constituting a secondary selection environment for males to compete against one another in the struggle for survival. Do you honestly think that this state of affairs, so entrenched in the animal kingdom, is likely to remedy itself simply by providing more information to people and giving them more choices? Or do you not think that this discrimination will simply become more sophisticated and, in that sense, more deeply entrenched?
There's a lot of Gallic sound and fury in what you say, but où est le bœuf?
Don't you see? Women need to give up their dedication to beauty and docility and actively compete against men in the workplace.
But you're speaking as if there must be a trade-off between being beautiful and being productive.
I'm afraid there is. Otherwise, as Darwin says, women are simply left to be part of the selection environment.
Oh, Clemence, even Mr. Darwin thinks more highly of women than that. After all, he still places women in charge of reproduction, which is why he's so reluctant to have them curtail their activities with knowledge of contraception.
But, Harriet, being a political economist, has it not crossed your mind that the difference between production and reproduction is merely topographical?
Oh, no, not another one of your quixotic spelling
lessons. Hear me out. You have always written so eloquently about the capacity of women to think as well as men, and, in most cases, to do the work of men. Well, do you not think that the overall lot of humanity would be markedly increased by regularly allowing women to compete with men in all walks of life? At the very least, it would raise the standard of performance all round.
But who would mind the children?
The state, of course! Especially now we've got a republican regime installed in France. Rather than go through the haphazard process of mating and the uncertainties of home life, we can let the state set the conditions on who is fit to mate with whom, in what amounts, and in what environments.
Clemence, it sounds to me like you want to turn France into a factory for manufacturing French people.
Exactement! It is only once the state has handed over social roles traditionally assigned to the sexes that men and women will be equally free. Moreover, the children produced under such an arrangement will attach their affections to the societies that as a whole is responsible for raising them, rather than the particular set of parents who, by chance, happen to have borne them.
But don't you believe that there's an instinctive attachment between mother and child?
But instincts were made to be broken, Nepa? At least I always thought that was the whole point of being human.
Clémence does have a point there, though I don't mean to be signalling agreement. Clémence, you appear to take very literally the idea that our inherited traits are a kind of human capital, if you will, whose employment can be controlled just as much as ordinary forms of material capital.
My dear Harriet, our biological inheritance is nothing but a form of material capital. And the point of the state is to ensure that the nation's available capital is used as efficiently as possible to the benefit of as many as possible. Moreover, this is not something that I, or even the great Charles Darwin, invented. That's exactly how the Catholic Church has justified its mystification surrounding sex, and even how various caste-based societies around the world have explicitly regulated people's mating patterns from time immemorial. My own proposal differs from these religiously inspired regimes in that mine would actually allow people to lead useful lives.
Don't you mean force people to lead useful lives?
Surely, Harriet, you would be the last to deny that the Catholics and the Hindus are equally guilty of turning relative indolence into a principle of social organization.
Again, Clémence, you may have a point, but I do insist on the individual's right to decide for him or herself.
What Mr. James so quaintly calls the instinctive attachment between mother and the child has rarely played any discernible role in the reproduction of the species. Assuming that such a bond truly exists, on the contrary, it has always been a matter of political economy, rightly or wrongly gauged. Harriet, if you weren't still wedded to the theological idea that individuals need to make choices for themselves, as if they were standing before God, you would concede my point without reservation.
Oh, that poor Clémence. I think we've got another final guest that may have something to say on these matters. Just get the door. Madame Blavatsky.
There is quite a chill in the air.
Oh.
You did not tell me that others would be present.
Well, yes, I only learned that they would be passing through on short notice.
Just because the notice was short doesn't mean that the purpose has not been long planned, though perhaps not by you.
Well, yes, whatever. Let me introduce Madame Elena Blavatsky to Mademoiselle Clémence Royer, a French publicist who has acquired a certain notoriety in her native land as the translator of Darwin's Origin of Species. And over here is Mr. William James, who is touring Europe after having completed his medical studies in the United States.
I suppose I should offer my apologies as well, since I had not expected to arrive in London so soon.
Oh, and where have you been, Madame Blavatsky?
In Cairo. My husband was scheduled to perform at the opera, but he died there en route.
My condolences. Oh, what exactly did he die?
Mr. James, I'm sure your keen medical curiosity need not be sated so quickly. Would you like some tea, Madame Blavatsky?
Yes, that would be lovely.
So, what exactly is it that you do, Madame Blavatsky?
I am a seeker after the hidden truths of the universe.
Yeah, aren't we all? But specifically, Madame Blavatsky, what is it that you do to earn a living? Do you have an inheritance from your family, or for that matter, your late husband?
Actually, I have been twice married. The first time, the marriage was arranged, but I escaped from my betrothed on horseback. My father chased me across the Russian steppes, but I managed to outwit him, having persuaded a captain to transport me from Odessa to Istanbul, and I have not returned to Russia since then. So, mademoiselle, in answer to your question, I make my own way in life. I do not depend on men. My only source of sustenance is the energy I channel from the cosmos.
And how exactly do you channel the energy?
She farts.
She what?
You heard me, Mr. James. Madame Blavatsky is an accomplished farter. People have been paying to hear and smell her farts all across Europe. And soon, she will be travelling to New York to perform similar feats of intelligently designed indigestion. Oh, no, Madam Blavatsky, if you're going to start channeling in my parlour, I shall have to open the windows, and it's already cold in here.
Don't worry, Miss Martineau. The conditions are not ripe for a transmission. If and when the conditions are ripe, you will hear me issue a shudder before the transmission occurs.
Oh, well, let's hope it doesn't happen. In any case, I hope you didn't bring any of those bloody cigars. You really are the original smoke and mirrors show.
Well, if you don't mind, Madame Blavatsky, how exactly are your farts supposed to channel what you take to be the energy of the cosmos? Mm-hmm.
This energy, the life force of the universe, flows naturally throughout all of space. But once it becomes concentrated in matter, it can lead to blockages that create all sorts of turbulence and disturbances. Some, like my farts, are experienced by witnesses only secondhand. But others, such as the spirits I sometimes conjure up in seances, are experienced firsthand by all present, including the skeptics.
With all due respect, Madame Blavatsky, I can see why Miss Martineau invited you here. You're part of her stealth campaign to persuade me of the merits of mesmerism and affiliated spiritualist doctrines.
I can assure you, Mr. James, that this is not the case at all. Perhaps Madame Blavatsky anticipated the momentousness of her visit here, but I did not.
Mr. James, surely you are familiar with the rapid pace with which we are gaining an understanding of the invisible forces of nature that seem to defy our common sense perception of the world and even befuddled the great Isaac Newton.
Well, if you mean what is increasingly called electromagnetism, yes, but what of it?
Then you know that first it was discovered that a magnet could induce magnetism in an adjacent piece of iron. Then that a static electric charge could induce such another charge in a neighboring body. Final Michael Faraday came along and did the same thing for electric currents, resulting in the electrical generators that have sprouted up in lighthouses along the English coastline. Most recently, Professor Clark Maxwell in Cambridge claims to infer from this chain of insights that electricity and magnetism, and possibly even light, are all the same thing, expressed in different forms. Science is quickly coming to a precise knowledge of the media of spiritual transmission, what Maxwell himself calls the ether.
All true, Madame Blavatsky. But you seem to have left out that Maxwell normally makes his claim with the aid of crystal-clear mathematical formulae, not mere sealing wax and string, as Faraday had done in his experimental demonstrations. Of course, this made for great fun at Christmas time when Faraday did his public lectures at the Royal Institution. But in any case, Maxwell certainly does not fart his way through physics experiments to draw his conclusions.
Well, actually, Miss Martineau, Clark Maxwell rarely does experiments himself. He imagines what general principles might underlie them, were they done under ideal conditions, and that intellectual feat might involve producing something like the mechanical model of the ether that Madame Blavatsky referred to.
You see, Miss Martineau, even physicists have got into the business of channeling the spiritual world.
Hold on, Madame Blavatsky. I've been listening patiently to your talk about channeling, and from everything I have read about you, I gather that all you have succeeded in channeling is other people's work. Many claims of plagiarism have been made about your writing, some even backed by lawsuits.
Yes, of course, there are naysayers who strike out of fear of what they fail to understand. But I would have thought I could count on women of such independence of mind and critical judgment as yourselves to recognize an outmoded legality when they see one. I am afraid that plagiarism, no less than its mirror image possession, is based on faulty metaphysical assumptions. We do not own what we say, and hence it cannot be stolen. What we say has usually been said many times before. The appearance of novelty and originality is merely a function of our forgetfulness. You mentioned mesmerism earlier, Mr. James, and that is certainly one proven way of enabling people to unblock their conscious minds so that they can channel those forgotten memories more effectively. Do you have a taste for metaphysics, Mr. James?
Well, I can smell it a mile away, and it's always foul. No offense, Madam Blavatsky.
I suppose if the metaphysics in question is life-enhancing, I can certainly abide it.
Well, the secret of the cosmos goes back to astrology, a science attached to the most of the world religions, however much they may have differed over dogma. Everything derives from the stars, and it is composed of stellar energy channeled through the ether. Some forms of matter, especially organisms, and especially certain humans, function particularly well as transmitters and receivers. I would not be surprised if Faraday and Maxwell secretly dabbled in astrology, much as Newton had done. They all seem to have had rather spiritualized view of Christianity. There is a euphemism in English for this state of mind. Unitarian.
Be careful, Mrs. Madam Blavatsky. My brother was a Unitarian minister, and to be sure, that is the basis of my own spiritual leanings. But I don't want to be implicated in any astrological hocus pocus.
Suit yourself, but can't you see that we have already begun to develop technologies based on our innate stellar powers? Consider the case of telegraphy, which is based on telepathy.
Oh, Madame Blavatsky, I'm afraid that you have got the causal arrow the wrong way round. Telegraphy is not modelled on telepathy. Telepathists like yourself rely on telegraphy as an imaginative anchor to persuade non-believers that there might be something to your powers. The problem is that we can actually follow the wires and the cables that enable telegraphic communication to occur. Your powers would seem to be wireless.
And who's to say that there won't be wireless communication someday? Once we tap into the relevant, forgotten memories.
Well, maybe it's best to change the subject. Clemence, before Madame Blavatsky arrived, you were talking about some ideas you had for identifying hereditary deficiencies that might overall improve the condition of humanity.
Yes. It involves opening up people's skulls and peering into their brains.
That sounds a bit drastic. Don't they need to be dead first?
Well, yes, of course! In fact, I've helped the start-up clubs up and down France devoted to what I call the Society for Mutual Autopsy. It basically involves a voluntary agreement amongst mutual acquaintances to open up each other's skulls once they have died, and to record meticulously the various cerebral fissures.
Clemence, that sounds perfectly hideous. Have you become some sort of grave snatcher in your middle age?
No, Harriet! We now know from examining brains of those who die in hospital what sorts of ailments are associated with various creases on the brain's surface. The Society for Mutual Autopsy aims to make the divulging of the information a civic obligation that would be duly forwarded to a national registry. Don't you see, Mr. James, the people who are best positioned to make judgments about the significance of particular cerebral fissures are those who knew the deceased intimately. They would be able to explain any idiosyncratic brain patterns as the imprints of a unique life experience.
And what exactly would be the point of this exercise? Especially given your lack of sympathy for spiritualism. Why all this fuss over the brain?
Madame Blavatsky, you are being deliberately obtuse here. The Society for Mutual Autopsy would unify the most private and the most public forms of social interaction under a scientific rubric, all for the greater glory of France.
So, there is some French spirit that you are trying to promote by all this cerebral probing.
Why, yes! Is there something wrong?
Well, I am puzzled. given your avowed materialism, that you would be so eager to sort of organize people in such an artificial manner, to promote something that, by your lights, shouldn't exist at all, namely the French spirit.
But this is just a manner of speaking for the Darwinian struggle for survival. You missed my earlier discourse about the need for nations to remain competitive by adopting efficient production and reproduction strategies.
That seems to be a lot of trouble to put people through for a conception of life that ultimately results in extinction.
Madame Blavatsky, are you channeling Charles Darwin now?
Well, at least Darwin understands the full extent of what he is rejecting when he rejects the spiritual world. I am not so sure, mademoiselle, whether you understand the full extent of what you're accepting when you accept materialism.
Madame Blavatsky, I'm at a loss to know where you're taking us with this interrogation.
Well, Mr. James, since you have received your training in medicine only in the recent past, you may not realize that only a few years ago there was no consensus whatsoever concerning the brain as a principal organ of our mental life. On the one hand, the clerics refused to admit that the mind could be pinned down to any part of the body. After all, that would open the door to external manipulation. But even worse, at least from their standpoint, it suggested that some other group of people, including mediums such as myself, might have more direct access to the soul than they do. On the other hand, the anti-clerics were typically materialists who believe that mind is simply another name for the organization of matter, to which is present in varying degrees throughout nature, but ultimately is nothing special, or at least nothing that might repay concerted study.
Madame Blavatsky, you exaggerate the polarities here.
Perhaps, but the fact remains that the people who were the most prescient in recognizing the human brain, the primary organ in nature for communicating with the entire cosmos, were avowed spiritualists. Not only Franz Mesmer, but especially his own inspiration, the great Swedish mining engineer, Emanuel Swedenborg, as well as Mesmer's contemporary, Franz Joseph Gall, the originator of the cranioscope used in phrenology, and in our own time, the person who follows most closely in their footsteps, and he is someone I recommend highly, is the evolutionist Alfred Russel Wallace.
But Madame Blavatsky, these are all scientific misfits that you've named, even Wallace. To be sure, these people have their followers. But when Ralph Waldo Emerson said ours would be the century of Swedenborg, he was referring exclusively to Swedenborg's mystical readings of the Bible and his dream interpretation, not his theory of the brain, which I gather was based on a critical reading of medical accounts rather than any original research.
Well, Mr. James, sometimes reviewing all the evidence with a fresh pair of eyes is all that it takes to bring about a scientific revolution. Indeed, sometimes less is more when it comes to research. Especially if one is in a frame of mind, receptive to hearing voices from the past.
I won't be a moment. Yes, officer. Madame Helena Blavatsky. Why are you asking after her? She fails to pay her passage from Cairo to London. Do you have a warrant for her arrest? You say you smell something sinister coming from this house?
mention my name. My name is Steve Fuller.
Steve Fuller.
Yes, yes. Yes, as I mentioned at the beginning, I think, I am recording this, and it will be put on my website, and I also plan to put the script of the play as well, so you can sort of read along if you want to. Yeah, I plan to work on this some more as well. I mean, the Darwin play that I did last year was about 75-80 minutes, which was quite long. I mean, it was okay, but this is kind of a more condensed version. But there's a lot more that can be said about a lot of these things that come up in the play. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I say this was absolutely brilliant for several reasons. As a gastroenterologist, most of my life's work is research on peptic ulcer, not about the other wing problem. I'm working on that right now, but in a different way. But one of the things is, when I became a consultant physician, a gastroenterologist in 1973, it all seemed easy. That's because I was starting then. I had no conceptions till I started to look at older literature, how very confused it was. At that time, the view, particularly in the 19th century, well, peptic ulcer was probably first accurately described. Well, one was by Lenin himself, and the other, it was around about 1850 or so. But at that time, the view in Scotland in particular, which was much more advanced than in England, was to look at things holistically. This section was frowned on as being full of artifacts. And if you dissect a corpse, as I have done as a medical student, it's easy if you're clumsy like I am, which is why I'm a physician, not a surgeon, to make holes in organs. But this is how peptic ulcer used to be regarded as. It was proven to be otherwise. And for a long time, peptic ulcer, it actually was a diagnosis when the PhD student actually showed this, of which it was completely unaware. It was thought of as being sinful. That was a medical diagnosis. This was used to be gluttony and so on. As I'm sure 100 years from now, people will look at our practices today and must marvel at our absurdity. As for the matter of the wind, it's well, it's a strange business. It's not my natural field. But it was, I survived a critical illness against expectation, and also with just recovering. Sometimes, of course, strolling through both fields and getting back into physical fitness. But one of the things that was quite remarkable was the difference between cow droppings and horse droppings. They look very, very different. And so, persuaded member of our staff, get me some cow and horse droppings and the x-ray things, and you can actually see it's the water content that makes the difference. And the gases produced are very different. And today, we've just been experimenting, starting with the very first indications, you can analyze feces or urine or blood and get a characteristic emission of volatile compounds. Absolutely characteristic. There is almost nobody in this room, I guarantee you, there is almost nobody in this room where, unless there is anybody who has never, ever had diarrhea. Has anyone never had diarrhea? Well, if you have had diarrhea, I think you would agree with me that you can smell the difference. It just is a fact. Now, it just so happens that Western medicine does not give confidence. Because Western medicine is deeply steeped in the tradition that you cannot measure does not exist anymore. That is part of the scientific proof. Rather than perhaps to take people like the Eastern aspect, being from the East myself, take the more holistic view, which of course leads to all sorts of peculiar beliefs, some of it accidentally true, a good deal of it not. But who can deny Mesmer laughed out of court? But can somebody explain to me the rational basis of hypnosis for doing this sort of a thing in front of somebody? Others will be burned at the stake for that. And yet you can hypnotize people. And we have any number of patients. Some patients die because the illness killed them. There are others the patient lost. The power of the spirit really see people who, against all expectations, survive much longer than expected. This in science we call as random variation, a wider standard deviation. A good deal of biological science is still shrouded up in mystery. The 19th century was truly, and the 20th as well, truly the world of physics. Biological science is, because it's so closely related to our inner selves, is, I think, more difficult to understand. And if I may say, I thoroughly enjoyed this. I had no idea that so much would be done. Take this true. The simple stuff was steeped in so much controversy.
Yeah.
So to all of you ladies, to you, sir, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Most of
them. Other remarks, questions? People might want to know, did they really say that?
Society for Mutual Orthodoxy.
That happened.
Yeah, I definitely want to run away and Wikipedia that. That is Society for Mutual Autopsy, right?
Yes,
if there is a book about this. It's called The End of the Soul. Or it's either The End of the Soul or The Death of the Soul. But I'll tell you who the author is, because I'm sure about that. And that's Jennifer Michael Hecht, H-E-C-H-T. Columbia University Press, 2003.
Yeah, I'll do it.
I'll do it? Okay. And the thing is, Royer was part of this kind of clique of Republican French intellectuals. You know, so the empire has fallen and you've got the Third Republic in place. And these people are they think of themselves as being very modernist about stuff. And they're very anti-clerical. And they basically establish a cult. This turns out to be a cult of these people who are friends. And as each one of them dies over the end of the 19th century, it gets very gruesome after a while, right? Because who's going to be the last one, though? You know, the one who's going to open up the brain of the last person if there's no one? Because they don't end up recruiting anybody. That's the interesting. The punchline of this is they don't recruit anybody beyond their generation.
What a shame. They'd have been so educated by the last person. They start to live their brain. They know everything.
Well, you know who actually writes a little bit about this in some of his early notebooks is Freud. Freud thought this stuff was kind of fascinating. Yeah, if you look at some of when he's still interested in neuroscience.
Okay, so I assume Kuhn vs. Popper.
That's me.
Yes, I like it.
That's me.
Context.
Yes, yeah. Sorry, I didn't give my name originally. That's really bad. That's bad PR. I'm Steve Fuller. I'm professor of sociology at Warwick University. Yeah.
Could you expand on the idea of farts and spirits?
No, but that's real. I mean, that part of the story is real. I mean, they really did. Because see, one of the things that's very interesting about spiritualism, which I'm trying to bring out in the play, is that spiritualists took very seriously the issue that the spirit has to be conveyed in a medium, and that the medium, you know, there may be blockages, and what is evidence of those blockages? And one of the things that's true about the process of mesmerism and hypnosis is that people have to relax, right? And things get released when people relax, and often they utter shrieks and other sounds and things of that kind. And farting was actually seen as part of that whole arrangement. You know, so especially you got somebody like Blavatsky, whose entire being is a medium, right? So as it were, everything she releases from sweat, right, and tears and farts and all those releasing mechanisms, right, are, as it were, signs of transmission, okay? And then if you're a particularly receptive, sensitive person, right, then everything you're doing kind of fits into that category. And so farts would fit into that category as well. You see, so it's in that context. But I think that's the interesting thing about spiritualism. They really tried to be very literal about exactly how the mind is passing through the body and whether the mind is being blocked by the body. They have this very kind of literal understanding of that. I mean, the other thing I think is quite interesting, I don't know if you, and this is kind of the feminist angle on this, is that all of these, that emphasizing the receptiveness side of hypnosis and mesmerism kind of gives a very positive, empowering spin to something that traditionally was seen as a weakness in women. Right? Being receptive, being passive, right? Yeah, exactly. And here, all of this stuff then becomes a source of knowledge because it enables you to function better as a medium. So, and this is why all of these women, right, in one way or another, are seen as part of women, you know, a pro-women kind of feminist sort of thing. And Blavatsky, in particular, this business now about not being dependent on men and living a very independent existence and so forth, that's for real, right? I mean, she wasn't passing leaflets to get women the right to vote or anything like that, right? But nevertheless, she was very much her own person and made that very clear and said there was this very special kind of power that she had.
She had two husbands.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's right, and they both disappeared under mysterious circumstances. No, it is.
I was particularly interested in Madame Blavatsky because I've long had friends in Germany who are theosophists.
Yeah.
And of course, they've taught me a lot about these earth powers and even in flowing water. You know, they've talked about it very seriously about the powers flowing through life. But of course, they also talk about Rudolf Steiner.
That's right.
And I assume that somehow Rudolf Steiner picked up.
Well, yeah, he was originally a follower, and he's basically kind of the prodigal son kind of person. He's this, you know, he's the one who splits off from them, yeah. And,
and he was a clairvoyant.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's a spiritual power of some kind.
And also, one of the things that he did was he kind of made it a bit more respectable in a way by establishing curricula and hooking it up more directly with German idealism and Goethe and some of the, you know, more native European traditions. Right, so it didn't just seem like some exotic Russian thing, you know, of mysterious origin with Eastern affiliations, but actually had a root within the German philosophical culture. And I think that really helped. It's helped remain quite legitimate. So if you go to, like in Scandinavia, there are loads of theosophy schools and things of that kind. Yeah.
He also, I think, was responsible for the Demeter biodynamic, biological, organic system where you mix ingredients in the horn of a cow. I mean, this still goes on in the Demeter organic process. And you do that at a certain phase of the moon, very important. And then you put that into a composting and gives it power, passes power onto the plants.
There you go.
Oh, yes,
I
remember that a couple of days ago.
Yes, highly, you know, just a few observations.
Wait.
Yes, the Demeter process, which you'll certainly find in Germany, also somewhat scattered in this country, is a type of biodynamic, organic growing of food. They have this remarkable process where you mix certain ingredients, certain natural elements, in the horn of a cow. You do it at certain phases of the moon. Then you place that into a compost heap, and you get you pass some sort of power into the compost, and then into the plants. Mm-hmm. So this is part of the Demeter process.
Ruben, sorry, I've been looking for you for the last hour.
I know it's not very well signposted. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
Anyhow, I just wanted to add to that I live in that beautiful country, all the wonderful Steiner schools. People who turn into books that we have in Scotland. Outstanding places. So, I'm wanting to add that because that sounds to some people a bit tacky, what you just said. I don't think so. But the schools are manifestly a blessing on this side.
Are there. Yes, sir.
You mentioned it's not very popular to have papers reading free will and service. Afro-Caribbean can only meet certain kinds of choices because their genetics limits them. And things like you have verbal responses to certain things, verbal reactions, and you kind of limited by the environment. And you had also this inspiration to find your nation or your room in the world. Did James ever come up with a definitive kind of conclusion about?
Oh, yes, he was a free will person. Oh, yes, he was a free will person. In fact, Martineau's comments about the will to believe, right, I mean, they are really, James really picks up on that stuff. And in fact, this is William James's justification for belief in God, actually, because he believes that, he believes, first of all, that you decide to believe things, that belief isn't something that it's imposed on you by experience or anything, it's something you just decide to do. You can believe anything you want, and whether you should believe it depends on what the consequences are for your life. And what he argues is that actually belief in God tends to be a good thing for people. People who believe in it tend to, you know, live longer, feel more meaningful in the world, blah, blah, blah. And so from that, he used that as an argument for believing in God. Not for the existence of God, but for believing in God. No, but I mean, and so the thing is, for him, right, he has this very voluntarist notion of belief, right, where belief is something you affirm. It isn't something that you're necessarily trying to get in correspondence with some pre-existing reality. Okay, that's where he's coming from. So he is, in that respect, he's very influenced by a lot of this kind of empowerment kind of stuff that Martineau and, you know, and Ralph Waldo Emerson, you know, he comes up in the beginning. Ralph Waldo Emerson's just full of that stuff. And James really goes for that. And in fact, James often attributes his, as it were, conversion to the free will position as getting him out of this kind of chronic depression and sort of aimlessness that he had during his younger years. Because basically, it's when he gets back to Harvard in 1872 and starts his first job, he just turns around. He becomes purposeful. He suddenly becomes the William James we've come to know and love kind of person. Whereas beforehand, like in this play, you know, he's all over the map, right? And at that time, he still kind of believed in determinism. And that he believed in some way he was fated to be one thing or another. And so, you know, he was always reflecting on his relationship with his father and whether in some sense there was something biological, that just as his father was kind of weird, that he would be kind of weird too, and, you know. But he just renounced all that.
They're irreconcilable with his medical background.
Well, I think, William James was one of those people who actually did, you know, believe in this business that you participate in your own recovery and stuff of that kind. He never practiced medicine, but he established the first psychology lab at Harvard, and part of his motivation for doing that was to actually get to see how people's beliefs changed the way they responded to things, how their sensory responses would change if they thought certain things or believed certain things. That was very much part of what his program was. So he, you know, that was, so he, you know, he's one of these guys who, you know, I think you would say he had a, you know, he would be rather benign towards something like the placebo effect, right? He wouldn't see that as a problem. He would see that as kind of a fact that is not surprising, okay? Yeah, that's the kind of person he was generally. And it's interesting because the line of self-help literature that you get, you know, especially in the United States starting in the 1920s and so forth, a lot of it draws inspiration from a lot of the later essays of William James, which were typically published in popular forums, you know, so, you know, like The Will to Believe and things like that. He would often give them as speeches himself, kind of morally uplifting things and so forth. To women's clubs, yeah, he was very interesting. So a lot of these kinds of views, especially Martineau's views that I'm attributing to her in the play, William James kind of picks up on, and it makes him kind of, you know, liberal, right? American liberal.
Yeah.
Yeah, he could have known. William James was internationally very well known and did a lot of was constantly traveling to Europe throughout his life and doing lecture tours and things. So that's entirely possible, actually. It's entirely possible that Wilde would have. James was enough of a public intellectual for that to have been possible. I mean, one book I recommend if you want to get a good sense of kind of, you know, James's life and kind of his background. You know, he was the brother of Henry James, the novelist, right? I mean, and the father, the senior, is Henry James Senior, right? Is this book called The Metaphysical Club by Louis Menand. I don't know if you've heard of this book. The Metaphysical Club was the name of this club in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the 1870s, where all the original pragmatists kind of formed. William James is part of this. And it's basically how this whole very uplifting, positive thinking, liberal, kind of a characteristically American philosophy got developed. And this book, The Metaphysical Club, it kind of does a sort of collective biography of all the people who were involved in this, including William James. Louis Menand, M-E-N-A-N-D, and the book won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction about 5 years ago in the United States. Yeah, it's in paperback. It's a very interesting read to give you the kind of context. And when I was doing research for this play, a lot of the connections with Swedenborg and things like that come up in the end about the various spiritualists, that's recounted in the book too, and also this very vexed relationship between William James and his father, because his father is basically the one who introduces William James to all this spiritualism. Yeah.
Steve, are other people today, like, sorry.
Go ahead.
Are other people today, like these three wonderful ladies and yourself, as William James, who are having the same sort of inspiring, thoughts?
I don't know. Let's put it this way. We're not a club.
Maybe we're not conscious of it. Okay.
No, I mean, look, you know, part of the thing here is I find it very useful to write these things and have them performed actually as a way of seeing what the consequences of these ideas are when they interact with each other. Sometimes very difficult to kind of think about them in the abstract, but when you have people actually acting them out and kind of, yeah, it does, and embodying them in various ways, you begin to see what's at stake. Where would be the disagreements? What other kinds of things would go along with it? I don't think academic culture generally encourages this way of dealing with ideas, frankly. I think there is a tendency for things to, you know, where you just deal with a slice of the idea, you might say. Yeah. You know, the part that's relevant to your discipline. Because if you look at it, all these things that we're talking about here cut across so many different disciplines at once. And in a sense, that's the only way you can really understand what it's all about if you're willing to, as it were, take all those disciplines as being equally in play. But there's really no incentive, and that's why something like doing a dramatic form is very useful in that regard. You know, I mean, my own inspiration, I guess when I was a kid, I read a lot of Ibsen and George Bernard Shaw. Right, which was very much, you know, for those of you old enough to remember who these people were, I don't know anymore if people know about these guys, but in the early 20th century, many moons ago, you know, these guys were basically playwrights of ideas, you know, embodied in people and how people lived with these ideas and the consequences of it, and sort of, as it were, acting it out almost like as a little experiment on the stage. And that was very much part of what this form of theater was about, actually, in the early 20th century. And that's kind of my inspiration in a way for that, from the dramatic form. But there's really no incentive within ordinary academic culture, you know, within philosophy, sociology, whatever disciplines we happen to be from, to really push this. I mean, that's why this setting is really good, right? Because this is kind of a kind of public intellectual setting, right? So this is kind of an ideal setting for people, as it were, to get people in the audience, for example, who is receptive to this kind of presentation, for example. Right. This, I'll get to you, but this guy here, yeah.
I was wondering if you might say something about the genesis of a play like this, how you come up with the idea, and then how you go about collecting the material.
Yeah. I was thinking about, you know, it's funny, I was thinking about that because I was wondering, how did I come up with this? Because the Lincoln-Darwin thing was a natural, it was very much time-dependent, you might say, because of the 200th birthday thing. This happens, I should say, one of the things I'm currently doing is I'm writing a history of epistemology, the theory of knowledge, right? I'm writing for the last 3 years, I've been doing just generally lots of research in the area, and it influences lots of things. And one of the things that I found, to be honest, was that women, like these women, the women they're being, you know, that they play, the names do come up, but always marginally. But they're there. It's kind of like, you know, because as you know, if you think about who the main contributors to philosophy or science or whatever, everybody can kind of agree on them. But then there are all these kind of marginal people who don't disappear. They're kind of there. You never quite sure, what are they doing there? You know, they're always popping up at weird places, you know? And very often they're women, especially in the 19th century. See, the 19th century is kind of a very interesting point for the role of women in society, because we're still talking about a period that's 50 years from the time women get the right to vote in most of the Western countries. But at the same time, women are beginning to get greater and greater access to education, and by the end of the 19th century, even universities. And so William James, for example, admits women into his psychology lab at Harvard. Okay. So it's right at that point where women are really beginning to kind of come into their own. And so all of these women, in a way, are making very strong intellectual marks, and often making very radical marks, and they're kind of allowed to make radical marks because they can't make the normal orthodox marks, because they're not allowed to go to the universities, they're not allowed to get the conventional degrees. And so in a sense, there are all these other avenues of exploration that suddenly become open to them. You see, and it's an interesting aspect of this, you see. So spiritualism, for example, right, once the official medical orthodoxy doesn't want to deal with it, doesn't want to deal with mesmerism or anything, right, then you start to get women taking it very seriously and really studying it very carefully because there's no competition for that. And then it ends up becoming a kind of power base. Once you can start to establish again that there is a certain kind of power, a certain kind of force that cannot be understood by conventional means, you see. And so all of these women in their own, and so the whole idea of trying to re-describe what reproduction is about biologically, you know, so somebody like Clemence Royer is very active in that, right, and trying to give it a spin that actually puts women at an advantage, because potentially, by emphasizing reproduction so much, Darwinism was potentially kind of consigning women to permanently just being childbearers. And that had, you know, and if Darwin is a progressive view, but the implications for women is very regressive, you've got to do something about that. And so this is where Royer comes in with this kind of eugenic idea, where the state takes over. And you're caring about populations as a whole, and all society takes responsibility. And, you know, a lot of the socialist thinking on child rearing as part of an egalitarian strategy between men and women in the 20th century was very much along those lines, too. Okay? So, I mean, I run across this kind of stuff, right? I'm doing this history of knowledge, and if you really want to do the whole panoramic sweep, you can't ignore these people. They're there. They're influential. They're making noise. Okay? I mean, you can even tell from, you know, what's going on in the play, who they're interacting with. You know, Charles Darwin's losing sleep over stuff here. You know, I mean, these aren't trivial people. Right? They do get forgotten from the history books, but in their day, they're very active and making some very important points, many of which, you know, deserve to be revisited or at least, you know, thought about in a somewhat different light. You, sir.
Yes. The one, if you go into traditional academic research space, it's head down, I've got to get a first or 2 months to emerge and get a job in the city bank, which is going to make up. Science has a way also, once you get through that, you stay in academia, it's how am I going to get the funding, how am I going to get tenure, and speaking out to it, not being too popular, it might be a good answer. And so there are a lot of pressures to stop people. Also, the people that start saying weird things, you can reckon 70% really are weak. 30% minus 30%. So scientists get very cautious about the approach. Yeah, it's interesting. I didn't know much about James in science. But Darwin, they seem to have both had that experience. People often say Darwin was an amateur. But he went to medical school, decided he didn't like it. Around medical school, he met people, talked to people, continued in medicine. Then he went to Cambridge, and hunting, shooting, fishing, naturalistic, and all the theological.
Oh, yes, very much so. That's right. And there is actually quite an interest. A history could be written of all the failed medical degree people of the 19th century. No, because you there. You know, it's not just Darwin and James. There's a whole lot of these kinds of people who went to medical school and then just decided they were not going to practice. But then nevertheless, that experience then opens them up to think about things. Because, you know, especially if you think about the way in which medical training took place back in the 19th century, it wasn't quite as, technical and narrow as it is today, right? So in a sense, it was quite a good place in a way to explore kind of larger ideas about the nature of life and things like that. So it's not surprising that people would have gone to medical school to get that kind of breadth, you might say, a vision that they then use somewhere else perhaps.
I'll throw in one fact.
Sure.
About emotions. I found this when I was writing my PhD many years ago. There's a very famous British ontologist called John Humphrey, who might have been FRS for his career, but he was very much a conventional scientist. Got peer reviewed publications. And he published a paper in the BMJ which showed that if you hypnotized one of the patients, you hypnotized the other, you could alter the course of the spread versus steam reaction.
Yes.
Can I just...
You're a former medical doctor. That's right, you are. You're one of them. She's one of them.
can I bring up the contemporary nature of the issues that you cover with the MBIC conversions?
Sure.
Nano with the benzene ring, info with the telegraphy, and bio obviously with Darwin. And Cogno with the phonology, and the issues of spiritualism and the search for MBIC conversions that we're currently looking for in science.
Do people know what this is? Is MBIC? This is quite a... Okay, this is a so-called converging technologies agenda. It's a very big thing in science policy thinking on both sides of the Atlantic now. It's kind of a meta idea, you might say. right? The idea is that you're trying to get research that brings about the convergence of nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and cognitive science for enhancing human performance. Enhancing human performance, that's the goal, right? Now, what does that mean exactly, right? Well, I mean, a lot of it has to do with enhancing the, you know, individual body in various ways to enable it to be more powerful and so forth. You know, so these debates that are going on at the moment about brain-boosting drugs all the time and whether kids should be allowed to use them, that's kind of the popular front of this. But there are large research agendas on both sides of the Atlantic, like the U.S. National Science Foundation and also in the European Union, that are basically, you might say, privileging projects that could be seen as contributing to this kind of agenda. Okay.
And who decides that agenda? Is it the politicians or the scientists?
Well, this is the thing. This is an agenda. You might say this is an agenda that's being set at the very highest level. So it's kind of like, you might say, a direction where you'd like to channel people's research to go. So you provide incentives, you know, saying.
Is it political or is it business putting the money?
Oh. And this would be, you know, government science policy things, both at the European level, European Union, and the U.S. National Science Foundation.
But it's not democratic. We don't vote.
No, I don't think there's been a vote on any of this stuff. No. In fact, the way in which you typically would encounter it would be by these relatively isolated stories, right? Where suddenly, a poll is done where 60% of people say, yes, I would take brain-boosting drugs to do better on my exam, and it should be made legal, right? And that just sort of pops out of nowhere, and you're looking at that and say, what the hell's that about? But that's actually part of something where there are some policy people trying to push our thinking in that direction and encouraging projects that would contribute to that. So that is something that's going on now. And so there is all this business about, you know, being able to channel impulses and things like this, but understood now in terms of information technology being embedded in our neural systems and that kind of enhancement. So in a way, revisiting a lot of this kind of stuff that these people are talking about in fairly abstract, vague ways in the 19th century as kind of particular policy things for various reasons. And you say, why are they doing this? Well, one reason is actually, it's an economic issue, namely the pensions crisis. You want people to be able to work longer and be more productive. And that's actually a very big driver from the standpoint of governments being involved. So you could raise retirement age, right? You can have people healthier longer so you wouldn't have to be fixing them up all the time. You know, really, that's kind of, so there's this kind of economic, welfarist kind of concern that's very much part of it, that I think is what drives it. But also, there's also the other economic side, you know, in terms of being able to sell new products. You know, so if you open up a whole new line of pharmaceuticals having to do with brain boosting or other kinds of body boosting, imagine the potential for that in terms of sales, range of products, right? If you legalize that, you just open up an incredibly large market. And that's the temptation, you see. And as soon as there's some determination that the public is open and receptive to this, like also with the doping of the sports figures, right? The same sort of thing there happening at that side. Yeah. And there are things...
What do you call the project? What name did you give to this?
Oh, this is called... It's called NBIC.
NBIC.
Yeah, Nano Bio Info Cogno.
Oh, right.
Right, and sometimes it's called the Converging Technologies Agenda because the idea is to have all of those different forms of research working toward human enhancement. What do you mean?
Delivery system by television? Is it soft?
Oh, there's lots of delivery systems. I mean, it could be like drugs, treatments.
No, I don't mean that. That's very specific.
Okay.
How is this being delivered to the general population?
Oh, you mean how are people being persuaded of this?
How are we being softened?
Oh, let me tell you. Lots of ways. Well, first of all, I think there's a whole strand within the bioethics community that gets associated with a movement called transhumanism, which some of you may have heard of, right? I'll give you an example. One guy who's always in the news in this country is John Harris, the professor of bioethics at Manchester University in the law school, who wrote a book a couple of years ago called Enhancing Evolution. Now, you see where that's going. And so he's there all the time, especially whenever there's exam season. You know that man's going to be in the newspaper saying, kids should have access to brain-boosting drugs. They want them? Why not? Okay? And there are people doing it on the sports side as well, you know. And the arguments get made along the lines of, well, look, you know, people take drugs already of various sorts, and just, you know, they hide it, right? And even in sports, there's always been changes to the technology to make people be able to run faster and so forth, and that's been allowed. So why not allow drugs as well? You know, so there's that softening up going on, but there's also stuff I'm a professor of sociology, and there are sociologists who do get commissioned by governments to run scenarios and focus groups and things like that, basically almost like market research for this kind of stuff, to get a sense of how do people think about this now? What are you scared by when you hear this? What do you like about this? And then all this stuff gets written up, and of course, the policymakers who commission this research then can act accordingly, you might say, in terms of the proper PR spin to give it. Right? So we sociologists will actually ask people, well, what scares you about this? What do you like about this? We write up our results. We publish them in various places. And then policymakers read this stuff and say, okay, now we know what to do. We avoid talking about Frankenfoods, for example, you know, or whatever, right? And we give this very positive spin on it instead.
So is this the ghost of Emerson?
Of Emerson.
Creepily.
Self-reliant empowerment.
His hordes of transcendentalists.
Well, see, I actually think those people wouldn't have any problem with this kind of stuff. I mean, because they really did believe in this kind of self-transcendence.
Self-identification.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean...
apotheosis.
Well, I'll tell you, an interesting thesis could be written relating Emerson to Ray Kurzweil. If you're familiar with Ray Kurzweil, the singularity is near, right, the age of spiritual machines, that kind of thing. And you look at the rhetoric of that about, you know, that our bodies are basically just the 1.0 version of humanity, but we can upload to more durable substances, you know, and enhance ourselves in various ways. This is a guy who takes like 40 or 60 pills a day or something, right? That's the kind of guy he is. And he's really advocating that we move in that direction. And the idea is that the current material containers that we have are just temporary arrangements. Right? We shouldn't think that this is the last story. And it's not just because he wants to have us evolve in a conventional way to another species. He's thinking about that we might go silicon. Right? We just leave the carbon universe behind. Okay? And now, what kind of a person has an idea like this, other than the crazy person? The kind of person who has an idea like this is someone who does believe in a kind of spirituality that can vary across media. Right? That in a way, the body, the particular body you have is not essential to who you are. That you could be, as it were, a better version of yourself in some other embodiment.
Kurzweil.
Kurzweil. He is the guy who invented the speech translating device. That's his. He made a lot of money out of this, and he's a kind of entrepreneur. But he made it, and it was out of the speech translating. But now he's this guru of this transhumanist stuff. That's what he's known for now.
So are you viewing the substrate neutrality? That's what you're doing as a spirituality.
Yeah, and I think that the followers
not
of
the
that
humanism.
What?
Not the humanism.
Well, the interesting thing is what exactly he wants to be preserved across the substrata. You know, what is being preserved. And he talks about, quote, consciousness. Right, exactly, right? Is that human, right? Is that sufficient to be a human? I don't know, right? I mean, it's called transhumanism, I think, primarily not because they necessarily are committed to preserving specific human things. I think they're kind of open-minded on that. But rather, it's the idea of transcending the current human body. I think that's kind of why it gets that name. And then people have a variety of views as to what that transcendence amounts to. NBIC, yeah, NBIC.
Because there was just something I wanted to know. And what is the military purpose behind it?
Actually, you're right. In the very beginning, yes, part of it was kind of a confronting, it's a sort of a, what do you call it? A deterrent system for biological warfare?
Yeah.
Right? Mm. That was kind of the original. I mean, the Defense Department eventually got off the trail. It realized it was too futuristic for it to really invest real money in. But that was, it's true. If you go to the National Science Foundation 2002 document on this topic, which you can get on the web, it's like 400 pages, it's quite clear the defense purposes are highlighted as a way of getting the DOD interested in it. So you're right. You got a point there. But that got dropped subsequently because they didn't think it was realistic enough.
But it will come back, I think.
For sure.
What a colleague was saying out there about, you know, what you were saying about it, it almost touches on rebirth.
Yeah.
You know, what you were saying. I'm a Hindu. It's part of our culture. And it has, whether one believes it or not, it doesn't matter. It gives me personally great comfort. The thing is, you're on this earth for today. You're dealt with the cards you've been given. The one thing you do not do as a good Hindu is you're not going to whinge. You do your duty until you get drunk. Provided you meet those criteria, you get promoted to a better life next time.
There you go. There you go. It's some spiritual meritocracy. I love it.
I know. My research fellow said, boss, you cannot possibly believe any of that rubbish. I said, I don't care whether I believe it or not. It comforts me.
Right.
Just as much of 19th century science, even after Einstein published relativity, it was believed that there was an ether that permeated all through the universe, which is how energy flowed through. So it wasn't such a crackpot idea that the leading scientists of the day believing that and offering proof.
Coming back to the military sort of
ideas.
I was fascinated by the idea in the play that there can't be a French spirit because she was a materialist.
Yeah.
And it's only the French spirit that causes a division between humanity, because you wouldn't have wars if you didn't have the natural spirit. That idea, is that your idea? Is that something researched? Where did that
come? Well, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the people, well, I mean, if you look at the kind of the imperialism that was going on in the late 19th century, a lot of the rhetoric of it was kind of spiritualist in terms of there being destinies for certain kinds of people and so forth. And if you look at Bismarck, for example, in terms of the rhetoric behind the German Empire, and it actually was true of the British Empire as well, certain kinds of Christian ideas are, so in other words, the part of the proselytism of Christianity, you know, it'd be the universal religion, right, that this kind of spread of the culture was kind of the secular arm of that. You get that both in Germany and in Britain as well. And where the essence of the culture is identified with this kind of spiritual core. You see, and that is a kind of a dissonant aspect of the sort of thing that Royer is talking about. And it's one of the things that comes up in this book about the end of the soul. Because these people are very militant Republicans. They believe, you know this whole Republican mythology about France, right? You know, where it's kind of like the religion of the country is this kind of secular thing. But what exactly does that mean in practice? Does that mean that you are spiritualizing the country, which is what Blavatsky is trying to get Royer to admit? If you're not, then what exactly are you talking about? And this is the problem I think that these really consistent materialists ran into problems with. And so part of the story that goes on is by the end of the 19th century, these people don't have a clear political horizon. Because there's nothing, they're very critical, they're very negative, they're very much against the church, right? But after a while, the church isn't really so strong anymore. And once they, once the church pretty much disappears from the school system in France by the end of the 19th century, it's not clear what they stand for positively. You see, and that's basically part of the story, why this group kind of died out. It wasn't just that everybody died, but also it wasn't clear what would be the basis for recruiting people of the next generation who no longer have to fight those old battles about the church.
But what I was thinking is it's even more emphasized now with the military being an arm of the materialistic world, and yet what has the military got to fight for if they don't believe in spirits?
Oh, but I actually think military, people who are very keen on the military actually do have a very spiritualist perspective, to be perfectly honest.
But they don't say they do, they say they're...
Well, if you think about Iraq, okay, and you think about the justifications for that war, I mean, there was, of course, the oil issue, but the official justifications were about spreading democracy and liberating people, and if you look at the neoconservative ideology, it's a kind of secular spiritualism about, this destiny of having this kind of American-style democracy all over the world, stuff like that. I mean, because, you know, look, you do need a kind of spiritual element if you're going to end up sacrificing a lot of people in the process, right? Because if you're going to justify war just in terms of, you know, the use of human capital, there are more productive ways of doing it, right, of using human capital than sending people to war, right? That's why strict capitalists, unless they can actually make money out of selling arms, don't generally like wars because they gum up free trade. Oh yeah.
And it was about the Black Watch soldiers coming back from Iraq. And what one of them actually said in there, very striking, was, "I'm not fighting for freedom. I'm not fighting for the greater good. I'm fighting for my mates and for the rape happen in my bearing."
Uh-huh.
Which is that very close spirit.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think that's always been that kind of that connection between spirituality and militarism has definitely been there. It's a very strong current. You can never deny that.
Yeah, sorry. You said that this group died. I'm kind of preempting what you just.
But the autopsy group. Yeah.
You said they died accidentally. That's a positive thing to argue for. What about eugenics? I mean, roughly when were they?
Oh yeah, no. Well, that was Royer's little hobby horse. You know, they didn't all jump on that bandwagon. But no, that's true. That's true. And there were a lot of people who were concerned about that at a practical level because France was suffering from declining population during that point. That's an interesting.
So is that why they actually put in the policies about family size?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they are set in the 20th century.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Okay. We're about 50, almost 20 minutes over, so should we call it a night? Thank you, sir. Thank you.
There's a particular thing. You almost never get to see ideas. You never get to see pop intellectual history or pop anthropology,
right,
or possibly
pop
sociology.
I'm
more a fan of.
What do you do?
I do nothing at all with this. I'm a hard mathematical physicist, modelling, but. I've got a friend who's an anthropologist, so obviously I get humanity to dribble through from a distance. So, and you know, it's good to switch. It's good. I enjoy reading intellectual history for no obvious reason at all, possibly because it's not sold in this work.
You
don't get to see it.
And
you can't
respond
to the marketplace. You can't. You're not going to see a film. You're not going to see a film
where a
sympathetic character talks about why they think eugenics is great.
Yeah.
You don't get situations. Well, I guess the point is you don't get situations where you can see someone or participate.
Sure, political theorists. Sure, of course. In fact, I had dinner with him.
Seeing someone embody a position which you're not
specific
to, which you can appreciate and go, I see why it seems absolutely reasonable to you.
And particularly when
you let the state. Why wouldn't you love rational government? Of course, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And particularly when there's untouchable characters like Darwin. The fact that you can criticise Darwin or point out inconsistencies in his writing or, you know, kind of the way in which he was racist and sexist and, you know, you're not allowed to say that.
It's a Victorian.
It's okay.
It's interesting, the number of things which are excusable. Like, for some reason, you know, people will have this in their own way. You know, King so-and-so, 1800, you know, had trouble with people's heads. Well, you know, that's what kings do, that's what nations do. For some reason, nation states are allowed to put Japan.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Stop trying to persuade someone not to write a book to send over. Sorry, I'm reading the answer. Why? I mean, you both of these people, you wouldn't like to like the king to see them now, but for some reason, it's kind of reasonable, okay. But,
I think it's for me a very important part of this is that the issues are becoming very contemporary again. And I think we've kind of almost come, I feel that there's a, not just a crisis, but this is kind of a renaissance. I think we've kind of got a return to, in some ways, a romantic view of the world. And you know, together with the romanticism of kind of this, we've almost got a pantheism where nature has become untouchable. We've kind of, you know, we've kind of done Nietzsche, you know, we've kind of killed God, kind of more golden. You know, there's spiritualism is kind of making God's making
it.
I'm not.
I gotta shut this off.